Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have as my guest Lisa Katona-Smith. Lisa is the founder of Parallel Recovery and a nationally recognized voice in the evolving landscape of family recovery. A certified peer recovery specialist, TEDx speaker, and author of the book Parallel Recovery, A Guide for Those Who Love Someone Struggling with Substance Use Disorder, Lisa brings over 20 years of experience as a master-level educator, combined with personal lived experience navigating a loved one's addiction. Motivated by the limitations of traditional support models, Lisa developed the Parallel Recovery Framework, a structured, compassionate process that helps families step into healing, reclaim influence, and rebuild connection in the face of substance use and mental health challenges. Lisa, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It is a pleasure having you on the program tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we got to give a shout out to one of the master collaborators of our generation, Portia Booker. Portia emailed me and said, boy, have I got a guest for you. She did the introductions with us, told me about your background. We had a pre-chat, and our experiences aligned, particularly my past experiences as an addiction counselor and working with individuals with substance use challenges and families who were trying to navigate those challenges. We found that we had a lot in common with my past experience and your present passion. So it was a no-brainer for me to say, yeah, let's get you on an episode. So
yeah, absolutely. Love Portia.
Yeah, me too. And I have some questions for you. I know you probably got some answers for me.
I do.
Whenever you're ready, we'll get going.
Okay, let's do it.
First question. Tell our audience about the experience or experiences that have shaped your current life path and your life passions today.
Sure. Yeah. So years ago, my oldest son, when he was in late adolescence, really started to struggle with mental health and then subsequently substance use disorder, and went through, and, you know, we were guided by several professional organizations, treatment centers, and he wasn't really getting better. He kept coming back to our family, and I sort of say that we kept messing up. We kept re-entering this relationship without any kind of change in the way that we loved him. And most treatment centers provide family programming of some sort. It's usually kind of at the end of a stay. You might have a couple family therapy sessions within a longer stay at treatment, but even 30 days is not, you might have one therapy session. Not a lot of work is getting done on how do we relate differently to this person so that we can support and help them. And what I started to discover was I was not shifting anything. We were not shifting anything. He was making changes and we were making none. I carried, as many people do, the belief that I wasn't a problem. This wasn't me. This was him. And everybody's heard the term addiction is a family disease. We say it all the time, but we don't actually address it. We just sort of say it. If addiction is a family disease, we actually have to support the entire family. And by support, I mean, you know, create a safe space for them to have their experience, which that's probably the base level of what is offered families, sort of a container to be felt bad for, which is helpful for a minute, but keeps people in a victim mindset. What isn't offered is a set of tools and skills to really move that family forward in relationship to the person getting treatment. So as a teacher, teachers are amazing self-learners as well. And I just went out looking for something better. Like this can't be it. This can't be all that there is. And found that there's a lot of evidence around family systems shifting and really creating a toolbox for them to be able to shift in communication, in their own personal journeys. And I started to discover that step one, I started to feel better. I felt better about how I was showing up as a mom to somebody who wasn't getting better. I felt prouder about myself. I felt more loving. I felt like I could be received by him in a way that was compassionate and the way I wanted to show up in my system of values. And then secondarily, bonus, he started to shift. It became an invitation for him to join the family on a healing journey and really change how we do life together. And I was pretty secret and pretty hidden, especially when things started in the early part of our journey, because it's not something that people bring you casseroles for. In fact, people think they can catch it. They leave you as opposed to help you. When I started to talk about our family and my son's journey and my own journey, people came out of the woodworks. You have to talk to my sister. Can I talk to you? Can I introduce you to somebody? And I started to discover that, man, there's a whole lot of people that are really handling this on a daily basis with zero to no support. My husband said, I think you need to help people. And I just sort of, as a teacher, was like, I think I can. And that's when I made a shift to really starting to become a spokesperson for families, expanding the treatment process to include them, and then creating a system that was kind of containered so that people could really actionably do something different starting today. That's how I got here.
And that's quite a journey. Typically, you know, the challenges that we experience in life dictate the path that we're going to take. And I'm glad that the challenges that you had with your son's addiction, his substance use disorder, has gotten you on this path where you are helping families. And a couple of things that you said that resonated with me. I used to work in a substance abuse inpatient program, and we're about 65 to 70%, Lisa, I mean, depending on the composition of the census at that time, had coexisting mental health disorders. But basically, all we had for families was, you know, family education sessions with a series of four sessions to be structured for 30 or 28-day program. And the bottom line is you can't do family therapy in an inpatient setting because it's too short-term. Essentially, you can maybe meet with a therapist and take a look at, put together some short-term or even perhaps long-term plans for family recovery and then refer them to a therapist in their area. I like what you said about inviting families to be part of the journey of recovery as opposed to being just detached bystanders and saying, well, it's not my problem.
Right. But
by bringing them in and taking a look at how can we build the relationship with the person, not the addict, where can we find common ground? Can we meet them with compassion, with love, with understanding, with tolerance, and at the same time, give those families and substance users the tools to address their recovery? That's a dynamite combination. And here's the other thing, and I can go on and on about this. Because a family or a person wants to come in and change doesn't mean they know how to. I mean, I wish I had a nickel for every client and every family that said, I want to change, but I don't know how to. Well, is that denial? No, it isn't. Denial is reality. If you've come from a family where there has been no coping strategies, and especially if that's been passed down from generation to generation, no, they're not going to know how to address and live a sober lifestyle. So we have to ask them, what do you need from us? How can we be of service? What tools can we give you and your family to work on together so that we truly are treating addiction as a family disease? How can we bring everybody together? How can we walk together on that path towards recovery?
Yes, I call it sharing the burden of change. If I waved my magic wand, families would go to treatment and everybody would get their own specific support and then be brought together in group support. That's just not, it's not feasible in our society and our, you know, insurance-driven model of care. So I really encourage professionals to have a conversation early with families that says, look, there's a couple of benefits of this. And one is going to be, you're going to feel less bad because you can't feel good the way this has gone. I know you can't. And you're not going to skip through the daisies because this is hard, but you can feel less bad than you do. You can feel like the power that you feel like you have lost can be directed in a different place as opposed to where you've been directing it, which is futile at the other person, but you can direct it at yourself. And then we can create tools for you to be able to model a way out of this because you're today the healthiest person in this equation. So let's utilize you. And I feel like families really feel empowered with that message, but it's not being offered in that way. And there is a nuance in the language of invitation that is really important to bring these families in because even families who come to me, they're defensive. I didn't do anything wrong. Well, I'll tell you, Dave, I didn't do anything wrong. My son got sick for various reasons, and he found a coping skill that was dangerous and very difficult to untangle. I didn't do anything wrong, but I did need help to be able to support him better.
How much of the reaction of families when they say, well, I didn't do anything wrong is because of the perceived stigma regarding addiction, or how much of it is just the natural defense mechanisms that they have developed to kind of cope with and survive their loved one's addiction?
That's a good question. I might say 80-20, 80% stigma today. I think it can shift, but 80% stigma, because here's what we believe, even if when we sit quiet with ourselves, it's shifting, but it's not shifted yet. We believe that someone who has an addiction problem is bad. Like if we want to get quiet with ourselves, they made bad choices. And there's some poor choices that are made when you're talking about addiction. And then there's a whole lot of other circumstances that go into it that make it way more complicated. And so families sort of have that stigma of they're bad. That must mean I'm bad. So that means I've got to be defensive that I'm not bad. So there's that. And then the second, the 20% piece is they just don't have another skill set. They're coming from a place of a fear because it's really scary. You know, if we were just talking about somebody like having poor penmanship, that the stakes aren't very high in that. There's not a scary outcome with something small like that, but there is a scary outcome with substance use. So families get very defensive about their fear. Well, if I don't do this, which is the only thing they know, control, manipulate, you know, try and get involved, then they might die. And it's a really hard conversation to have with people to say that your fear, which is guiding your actions that are not helpful, is not going to prevent the thing you're afraid of.
Exactly. I mean, what you fear, what you typically fear and you bring a conscious memory, that fear is going to manifest anyway.
Completely. I don't know if you're a mountain biker or skier, but I am both of the thing. And the rule is look where you want to go, not where you don't want to go. And especially with mountain biking, so many times I'll be like, oh, I don't want to go off that. And my bike will go there. Like it's, you go there, you go where you're looking. So, and it takes effort to look where you, to manifest exactly like you said, to manifest what you want to see and walk in that direction and quiet the distractive fear voices.
Absolutely. And one of the things you mentioned about families being defensive, and I teach an addiction and family course at Utica University. And one of the things I tell my students is that you cannot break through the defenses of families. You just can't go crashing through that defense mechanism. You have to allow yourself to be gently led. No matter how fearful a family may be, no matter how guarded they may be, they're going to give you a door. They're going to say, here's the door I want you to go through. Mm-hmm. And you have to be just smart enough and have good enough active listening skills to walk through the door that they're going to open for you, because that's going to build a relationship. And with family therapy, it's about building relationships ongoing with the family. It isn't just like three sessions and done. I mean, you could spend, and I'm sure you've seen this, Lisa, you could spend 1 month working on one aspect of a family system's challenges. That could be just communication, or active listening skills, or assertiveness skills, or just where one person is talking about their issues, the other person listens and then responds. I mean, you could be working, you know, a month to 2 months just on that one aspect. So I tell my students, it's about building a relationship. Yeah. And they're going to come in very guarded. They're going to come in very defended. They're going to come in feeling victimized. We have to empower them by allowing them to find their emotional comfort zone and allowing them to present to you what they need at that particular moment to move forward in recovery.
Absolutely. And it really is the skill of a good teacher to be able to do that. Because if you think about just educating people, telling them where they need to get and then not meeting them where they are today, they're going to fail. They're not going to have the skill set, the knowledge, the tools to sort of make those small steps. So you've got to meet families there too. You've got to be where they are. I have a phrase in my book that is, what's your hamburger? Which is about boundaries. And the story of that is, I worked with a family who had pretty much never said no to their adult child, who was wreaking havoc in their home. And so we started with dinner. And there was way bigger problems, to include pretty serious drug use in the home. So we started with dinner, and I said, okay, look, here's what we're going to do. You're going to tell all the people in the house by 3 o'clock, I need to know who's going to be home for dinner. And if you're not going to tell me by three, I'm just going to assume that you're not going to be here. And there's food in the kitchen, right? Like it's not like you don't get to eat, but you'll have to make mac and cheese. She was like, well, it's not a big deal to make more. And I'm like, no, it's not a big deal. The point is, they need to understand that this is a collaborative relationship and it has to work for both people. So that's what the mom started with. And the first day, her adult son did not tell her, and she made hamburgers. And her husband were eating hamburgers, and he came home and said, where's mine? And she was like, oh, shoot, you didn't tell me by three. And so I just assumed you weren't going to be here. There's food in the kitchen. And he threw a fit. And the next day, he told her by three. I mean, it's as simple as that. We didn't start with, you can't use drugs in my house. We started with, hey, I need to know by three so that I can plan the meal.
Yeah, it's just setting a healthy boundary.
Totally.
Which, you know, boundaries can become very rigid, and they can become very enmeshed in homes that have a substance user in a family system that has had, you know, a history of substance use from generation to generation. So it just starts with there. I like that. I might have to get a hamburger for lunch now.
Hey.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Tell us about the parallel recovery framework you have developed, and how does it address the limitations of traditional support models?
Okay. So first of all, it's not linear. And I want to explain, I'm going to talk about it linearly, but it's a process of gathering a toolbox, literally, of skill set, reflective skill set, action skill set, understanding skill set, compassionate skill set, and then implementing it in the appropriate scenarios. So I'm going to speak about it linearly, but it's not linear. And so really understanding ourselves first. We can't compassionately relate to another person if we don't understand what we're coming to the table with. So understanding, I say, who have you become in this disease? And who do you want to be in this relationship? And a personal example is, I had become a door slammer. I was slamming some stuff. And what I wanted to be was an inclusive person. And door slamming actually pushes people out, doesn't bring people in. So I talk about the shadow side of values, that we've got, someone might have the value of devotion, and it might be expressed as a martyr. That's a shadow side of the value of devotion. So really identifying, who do I want to be? How do I want my impact on this person to you know, be expressed, step one. And then I start going into, okay, so how do we start behaving and communicating that way? Speaking from yourself, understanding the other person's human experience, psychoeducation. What happens to the brain when we're talking about particularly substance use? Why are they doing what they're doing? They're not trying to suck. They really aren't. It looks like it sometimes. Looks like they're making choices to stink at life, but they're not. Who are you talking to in this relationship, the person or the addiction? And how can you start talking to the person and stop talking to the addiction? In order to do that, you need to be able to have your lens on of understanding the psychoeducation of the brain. Communication, meaning boundaries, agreements, and rules, which I'm not into rules, but we address rules so that the people understand when you say you can't use drugs in my house, that's not a boundary. And I would say, Dave, that boundaries are a little bit pop psych right now, or have been. I don't know. They might be going out of vogue for a while. I haven't seen it kind of pop up for a while, but I see professionals saying things like, you need to tell them this. And I'm like, that is not a boundary. Like, they're really not helping people establish boundaries. So really understand that when you set a boundary, you're setting this for you. And if you can't follow through, you're just going to be disappointed and resentful. So what can you do? What is your hamburger? We might have to start small so that you can move forward successfully. And they can be successful too. I work into personal grief and what the family has experienced, lost, have disappointment around, continue to lose. I really address ambiguous grief, which is complex, ongoing grief. And it doesn't have a Hallmark card, and it doesn't have a beginning and end. It's very confusing. And then I talk about self-compassion. Then I reference that in the terms of a U-turn. How can you be compassionate when you step in the mud? Because you're going to. You've been doing this for however many years you've been on this earth. It's going to take a second to shift. So how can you model and experience compassion for yourself when it doesn't go exactly how you thought it should?
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing too, I was smiling when you said you've heard therapists say, well, you need to do this. And, you know, I tell my students, just because I tell you that I could recommend that you do something, you only have to do a doggone thing because you have free will. So if I'm telling somebody that, who especially has ambivalent issues around authority figures anyway, and that can start in their family of origin, if I'm telling you need to do something, what I've done is recreate those dynamics that they're trying to escape from. So what I've done is I've contributed to the problem by becoming more authoritarian rather than asking, what do you need from me? What resources can I provide that are going to help you in this particular moment? That's different. It's less directive and it's more collaborative.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I like the fact that it's like, let's take a look at my son or my daughter, the person, as opposed to my son or daughter, the addict. Because one of the things I preach until I'm blue in the face to my students is you treat the behavior separately from the person. The addiction is a behavior. Mm-hmm. It does not reflect who that person is. In most cases, you're going to see this when these are individuals that are brilliant, that are creative, that are compassionate, but when they dance with their substance of choice, all of that goes by the wayside and they're seen as an addict. Your job is to see them as a person with addiction, but as a person of value.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's really about, that's hard. That's really hard for families because the behavior is coming out of the mouth of the person. You know, the visual of there's you, there's the person you love, and there's a third party involved that is very protective over the pain that that person is feeling, over the experience or the trauma or the whatever it is that they are masking, hiding, or running from with substance use. That addiction is a master at covering it up. Yep. And if we talk to the behavior, we're not inviting the person who's in pain to step out of it.
Yes.
We got to walk them home
to
themselves.
Yeah, just like Ram Dass, we're all just walking each other home.
Absolutely. When I speak in larger groups, I always like to start with, raise your hand if the person that you're here for is the creative one in your family, is the sensitive one in your family, is the one who thinks about the other people in your family, is the one who's the noticer in your family. And every single person raises their hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and you know, it's like, you know, you talked about ambiguous grief and complicated grief. And, you know, when I used to do a grief education lecture, when I worked in the inpatient facility that I alluded to earlier, I asked everybody, and how many of you have lost a loved one? Inevitably, everybody raises their hands. How many of you lost another friend or somebody that you knew who was also addicted? You never had a chance to express that because of the stigma that was around addiction, or what you heard, I was just an addict, so he couldn't have had any particular value to this world, which
and
a lot of times they will raise their hand and say, yeah, I never had a chance to express that. So I tried to give them some space to do that individually, because I think also that unexpressed pain can also contribute to relapse and also can contribute to relationship issues with their own family members. So,
it's beautiful. I love that. You know, many times families come and obviously they want to help their loved one get better. And I want that too.
Yeah.
And the numbers definitely show that if families engage in a system of support that's different than what's usually offered, hence parallel recovery, that the outcome of the other person exponentially gets better. However, it's not 100%, Dave. Not everybody gets better. No. And so sometimes, you know, I have a hard conversation with families that your person is carrying a whole lot of weight. And by the way, they might not say it. They do know that they're impacting you. They know it and they feel it. And if you can take the burden of your well-being off of them and be able to express, first of all, your own care, and second of all, care for them, the person, it might have to be far away because they might be really engaged in some terrible, terrible things that you've got to protect yourself against. But they will not leave this earth believing that they broke you or carrying the weight of your unresolved pain. And that's a hard thing to talk about, but I want to put it on the table because it's not just about getting them better. It's about the sustainability of you so that you can stay connected in this relationship and everybody has the best shot at an outcome. At least the best shot that we know of today.
Yep. And it makes sense because what we're looking at is long-term sustainability, not a short-term fix.
Exactly.
I know you provide specific services to families, and I also know you've been also a consultant to other organizations as well. Just tell our audience a little bit about those services specifically that you provide to families and organizations, Lisa.
Yeah, sure. So I work with larger organizations. I have a couple of great partnerships with people. And we do big comprehensive work, right? Like if someone needs an intervention or care management companions, that kind of big stuff. And, you know, follow up or lead up to treatment. And so there's providing of services for the person and I provide services for the family. And we just have a giant wraparound and it's really amazing. That is not accessible to everybody financially. Time-wise, there's lots of reasons why many people can't engage in that, but it's a really great, amazing partnership that I have with some people. Secondarily, I work just privately with clients to really change the process of their family system moving forward. I have a support group that is run online that's very different than what I think traditional support groups are. It is, I provide a topic and information every single week. We read it. We kind of, it's about us as family members coming to the table and working on us. We don't necessarily discuss what's going on with our loved one, although the group is really special and I covet it. It's a very protected space for the people. Some of them have been in there for years. I do a group program that I run through and license through treatment centers. It's exactly what I described in my parallel recovery process, going through all of those toolbox elements so that when you're going into family sessions or ultimately a family weekend at the end, you're actually coming in with tools to look different and sound different. Yeah. Yeah. And then I am actually currently working on a workbook and a facilitator guide for my book so that, you know, smaller outpatient programs or just smaller programs that may not have the ability to run an intensive system with their families can maybe facilitate a book study. And then last, I do weekend family intensives for those people who just want to get, I call it a vitamin B shot of parallel recovery. Let's go. Let's get a fast forward into these tools, and then you can implement them in situations. My goal, Dave, is, and it was my goal as a teacher too, is to teach you to be able to do this different. You shouldn't need me for a long period of time. You should come in, and honestly, treatment is the same. Intensive, less intensive, support, accountability afterwards, right? It's just, it should look that way. You should be able to gain the tools so that you can sustainably make this change long-term. Not you need to come to me and ask me how you're going to get through Thanksgiving. Insert the next holiday, and you've got the tools.
Yeah, I think the more responsibility we can help individuals assume and take for their own recovery, for their own actions, the less they're going to need us. And we kind of just position ourselves as an occasional resource person. If they have become too dependent on us, there is something that has been missing in that therapeutic relationship. And as therapists, we have to take a look at, what do I need to do differently? What could I have done to unconsciously or maybe even consciously foster that sort of dependency? What was going on within me that caused me to become totally invested in this person and family's success or failure? What's going on with me?
Yes, which is very much what I teach families. I call it the need to be needed, right? Like families sometimes have a box of need to be needed. I need them to need me so I feel valuable in this relationship. Okay, let's look at that. But I think as guides and models for support for families, we also need to look at that too. I should not be needed forever. I shouldn't. I'm doing something wrong, or they need to take a break and let things sink in and then maybe come back for level two. Like maybe they reached a false summit. They need to let it sink in, let some practice happen, and then come back for a level up.
One of the important pieces of therapy for me was always self-awareness. Taking a look at every intervention that I did or every conversation that I had with an individual with substance use in their family, how did it affect me? Did I communicate with them from consistent with my own value system? Did I find myself becoming too overly invested? And it's asking myself those questions and then going to my supervisor and saying, hey, I need some help with this.
Yeah, you're speaking my language. Absolutely. And if you think about this, Dave, insert exactly what you just said into the family system. In order for the person getting substance use support, addiction treatment, to really have a good shot at getting better, they need the family to become a part of the treatment team, which, by the way, isn't controlling their behavior. It's using the language. It's using self-reflection. I mean, that's what a good treatment support system is doing. You don't go to, let's just even break it down to a basic AA meeting. You don't go into an AA meeting and everyone jumps forward and starts solutioning for you. They sit back and let you have your experience. And that is what the family, but they do it with skill and compassion and compassionate witness. And that's what we need the family to do. And so it's training, it's bringing them up so that they can be a part of the treatment team at the table with everybody.
Yeah. And they can learn to just bear witness to their loved one's stories. And their stories aren't going to be pretty. And addiction isn't pretty, but it's bearing witness to everything. It's bearing witness to the good parts and also the shadow elements that define us.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to tell you about, I don't like the term rules either. I had a very wise supervisor and mentor who would always say, don't have group rules, have group responsibilities. That has a whole different connotation than rules, which for somebody who's anti-authoritarian, I don't need to follow those rules. But what about if we looked at those rules as responsibilities? What's a responsibility to yourself? And what's the consequences if you don't meet those responsibilities, not only for yourself, but for your family and your friends? How's that behavior going to impact on them?
I love that. And it really is an invitation to be empowered as opposed to an invitation to have an opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My supervisor and mentor, he was a visionary. I mean, he was talking about the stuff we're talking about now, empowerment, fostering independence and reliance. He was talking about this stuff back in the 80s. And he's been dead now since 1998, but boy, he lives on in me in terms of my teaching and everything I do. And also, he lived on with my continued work with individuals and families with substance use issues. So,
yeah. So, love that. I love people that inspire us.
Me too. Me too. And they continue to long after they've left this world. So, now speaking of your parallel recovery, speaking of your book, tell us about your book, Parallel Recovery, A Guide for Those Who Love Someone Struggling with Substance Use Disorder. What impact do you hope it's going to have on those who choose to read it, and also for the families that are struggling with substance use disorder?
Yeah, so there's two things that I want people to experience when they read my book. One is a set of tools, a guide forward, not just sort of touching on topics, but actionable things that can provide support for them to utilize.
Yep.
Second is a place for them to feel witnessed and for them to feel like it's not just a person telling me what I need to do. This is a person, I've weaved my story and stories of people who I've worked with throughout the book. And the first chapter of the book is called Hard Easy or Easy Hard. And that theme is just woven throughout the whole book. It's funny because people I work with closely, sometimes I'll have my own thing going on and they'll be like, hard easy or easy hard? And I'm like, I hate when you use my stuff against me. The story behind that is in 2012, I live in Colorado. My family experienced the impact of a wildfire on our neighborhood. Our entire neighborhood burned down. And we had a complete loss. And my kids were young. My oldest, who has struggled with substance use, was in the seventh grade. He was 12 years old. That's a very, that hard age on a good day. And it was a pivotal moment in our lives, in his life. And so I really want people to hear my story, but have the book not be about me. Have it be about, man, I had to bushwhack this. And just follow the path that I have found, it's way easier the second time through. And that's what I want, is just a set of actionable things that they can start doing today, as well as me too, a space for them to go, oh, okay, I didn't suck at this either. I just sort of woke up here and I don't know what happened. And people just like me experience this too.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I wanted. Those two things.
Yeah, and I think when you can write a book that is going to be a useful guide for families trying to navigate the substance use of a loved one, and also you put forward your own story with that, I think it makes it more impactful, because it's like you've been in the trenches with your son.
Yeah.
And, you know, and somebody who's been in the trenches also knows what they need to do to get out of that.
Yeah.
Get out of it.
For sure. And I will tell you that as a mother, when someone says, I know you're scared, I go, really? Do you know how scared? Because unless you're a mother who has experienced this, you don't know how scared.
No. You know, it's like somebody saying, I know how you feel. I lost such and such. It's not even related to the feeling. Their intentions may be good, but at the same time, it misses the mark. And if anything, it may also undermine that person's loss. It may undermine your challenges that you've gone through as a mother who has a son who had struggled with substance use issues. And so I never assume how anybody feels. I'll let them tell me.
Yes.
I can try and just try to show empathy as opposed to kind of like understanding, which you can't really understand unless you've walked it.
Mm-hmm. And even my experience is different than other people's experiences.
Yes.
So it really is about finding comfort in watching someone else's discomfort. And then again, extending your hand to say, there might be a way to not feel this uncomfortable.
Yeah. As therapists, as coaches, we need to be willing to sit in the muck
yeah.
with, and we experience that discomfort that that individual has gone through in order for us to be able to deal with it. We can't just sugarcoat it. We can't walk away from it. We have to really be in the trenches with them as co-companions, as a compassionate witness, to try to really get a feel for what those individuals and families have experienced in order for us to be able to adequately address it.
Yeah. Could I address something? I think it came to my brain when you and I were just talking about that, which is traditional models of support, like support groups. I'll leave it at that. I have a lot of clients whose loved one is in treatment and they go to, you know, the Monday night support group at the treatment center. It doesn't feel supportive. So here's the message that going out to the world, it doesn't feel supportive. And that's not helpful. It does not feel supportive to just be told, step back, step back, step back, step back. That's step one. You might need to step back so you can see the forest through the trees, so that you can take a breath, so that you maybe can have a solid night's sleep. And then what can I do to step back in? And that's what's missing is, and I think that, you know, you addressed it as good therapists, good guides, good coaches need to be able to, you know, really sit in the muck with their clients or people that they're supporting. But there's more support groups that are just sitting in the muck with people and just being mucky. It's like, we really can clean off. And again, it's not about, oh, this is perfect now. This is about learning to sustainability, learning how to navigate the waves of the challenge, because whether we're talking, no matter what brain disorder we're talking about, it is recurring, and it doesn't go away. It's not strep throat. That's not what it is. It's something that is always present, doesn't always have to be actively present, but it's always there. It's how are we going to put it in the back seat, notice it, witness it, address it when needed, and weather the journey. But in order to do that, you've got to teach people how to step back in.
Yes.
And I think traditionally, there's just a space to be felt bad for.
Absolutely. And I can see the element of detachment in terms of you detach, from the outcomes. You can't control the outcomes of your loved one's behaviors, and you shouldn't be any more responsible for it than you need to be. But the other part is just not detaching it and just walking away and saying, well, I'm done with you.
And the interpretation is that.
Exactly. That's just walk away. And that's, I think, what contributes to a lot of times getting whole family systems and just partial family systems into treatment, because there's some individuals and families say, wait a minute, yeah, I'm detaching, but yet I want to come in with compassion and be able to support my loved one in their recovery. And to me, that's, I think, where the message of detachment falls short. It's like, okay, detach from any responsibility that may have been put on you or you've interpreted for your loved one's behavior, because we have no control over anybody's behavior except our own. But how do we walk back in?
Yeah, detachment's not the right word. It really is.
No.
And the spirit underneath it is correct. Yep. It's really unentangle from the chaos, from the disruptiveness. Sometimes I refer to that entanglement as family members. We're like octopus and we've got all these legs, and then the legs have tentacles on them. We got to start peeling those tentacles off so that we can like actually see what's going on and give the other person the opportunity to try and do better. And that's a really important thing too. I said it earlier. Nobody tries to suck at their life. They really don't. Nobody wants to go, I know where I want this to lead. No, that's not it at all how this started. Empowering somebody by unentangling and giving the message that I'm here and I actually believe that you can join me.
Yeah. And it's basically believing in somebody's ability to transcend what they perceive their limitations to be. Yeah. You know, I tell my students, I don't care what you got in other classes. I don't care if you're a C student or a D student. I'm going to treat you as if you're capable of doing great things. I'm treating you as if you are going to be the most capable person in the world. And if we treat somebody as if they're capable, if we treat somebody who's struggling with substance use and mental health issues as if they are capable of recovery, we treat families as if they're capable of being a compassionate part of the process. If we plant those seeds, eventually it's going to bear fruit.
Absolutely. And you really emphasized why my process isn't linear, because what you just addressed was a whole lot of things, like understanding the disease, the disorder, understanding the person, separating the person from the behavior, and you addressed the need for boundaries. You make the assumption that somebody can do better and they don't. You create boundaries and you have space in the relationship to give them the opportunity to do better. Brené Brown says, when the most boundaried people are the most compassionate. And when you can create those boundaries, not rules, but boundaries, which is an invitation for somebody to do better, so that you can stay healthy in this relationship, you make the assumption that they're doing the best that they can today.
Yes. And that's something that a lot of times gets, you lose sight of. I mean, Don Miguel Ruiz in his book, Four Agreements, said, always do your best, but our best can be different depending on what's going on in our lives.
Right.
But did we do our best given the circumstances? And that's what we need to be able to help families and individuals who are struggling with substance use understand. Did you do your best at that particular moment, given everything that you were dealing with?
Yep.
So, Lisa, I could probably talk to you for about another hour, but I got a couple more questions to wrap up our time together. It's been a fun and a great conversation, and I want to thank Portia a million times over for getting us together. So one of my last questions for you, if there is one ultimate wisdom or takeaway that you want to leave our listeners with today, what would that be?
That your power lies in starting with yourself. The change that you want to see in your loved one begins with small bits of change yourself, that then you can create an invitation for them to join you.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes perfect sense. And I think if we could all live by that responsibility, I think we're going to be in good shape. My last question, to give you a chance to promote yourself and your services a little bit, if people want to contact you, contract for your services, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do that, Lisa?
Sure. I'm going to start with, I have a TED Talk. It's out there for free. The Power of Parallel Recovery. You can just Google it. My book, Parallel Recovery, The Guide, is available on Amazon, or you can order it with the ISBN number through your local bookstores if you'd like. My website is lisacatonasmith.com, and you can find out all about me there. And I'm most active on the Instagram, parallel_recovery.
Lisa, thank you so much for just a wonderful conversation today. I wish you well in the future with your work with families and organizations. And if we can clone you 1,000 times, I think we might be able to get a handle on the substance use issue, I think, with your philosophies, your passion. So let's work on cloning it 1,000 times.
Okay. Thank you, Dave. It's been an honor.
You're welcome. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.